This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Panchassi. My guest in this episode is Jeffrey Jackson, the author of Paper Bullets, Two Artists Who Risked Their Lives to Defy the Nazis. And the book was published by Algonquin Books in 2020. Hi there, Jeff.
Hi, Roxanne.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me. This is such a great podcast, and it's really an honor to be here talking with you today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you about this fantastic book. Jeff, I've been asking all of my interviewees where they are and how they've been doing during this era now of global pandemic. Do you want to tell us a little bit about you and your family and how that's all going?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We've been doing well. We've all stayed healthy, which has been great. You know, when we first went remote, remote teaching was obviously a shift, but I think everything worked out pretty well. Our kids go to a school that was able to reopen with very heavy masking and cleanliness protocols. And so they were actually in school for much of the pandemic. And I know that was a great blessing for us because they weren't at home all the time and they were able to see friends but still also be safe. So I think we were very lucky in that way. But we're just, you know, we've gotten as many vaccines as we can. And we're hoping that this will be over soon.
Jeff, the other question I always ask people on this French Studies channel is, you know, why France? How did you come to be a historian of France, among other things?
Well, it's a great question. And I sometimes ask myself that, too, looking back over the years. But I think in my case, some of it was luck, in a sense, because the school that I went to, the elementary school that I went to, they taught French. That was the language that they taught us. And so from a very early age, really starting in first grade, I was learning French and all the way through high school. And so I had a really solid foundation in French language and also French culture and, you know, the little bits of French history that you pick up in a high school class or something like that. The other source for me, I think, or the other reason behind it is that my grandparents did a lot of traveling as they got older and retired and they had saved up and they just wanted to travel. And so they went all over the world. I mean, they literally circumnavigated the globe. They went to Europe a lot. And so they would bring back souvenirs and photographs and stories. And so sort of putting those things together, hearing them talk about their experiences and then me studying the French language, I think I just kind of somehow oriented me towards studying European histories or generally, but French history in particular. When I went to graduate school, I didn't necessarily want to do French history. I thought I was going to do more intellectual history, actually. And then that was another sort of, I guess you could say, a kind of good fortune on my part was that I went to the University of Rochester when Alice Conklin was there. And so, mm-hmm. You know, we kind of clicked. So I had a good mentorship from those early days. And, you know, all those threads just kind of came together.
Jeff, I want to ask you about what brought you to the subject of this book. The last book of yours that I read was your last book, the book about the Paris flood of, when was
1910.
It? 1910. So yeah, I want you to tell us about how you came to the subject of this book and this project, but also how you see it kind of fitting into your oeuvre, as it were.
Yeah, I came to this book in some ways in a similar way as I did to the flood book, Paris Underwater. And I think it's just chance, really. good luck. Because this project, Paper Bullets, came about because my wife is an art historian. And she taught for a number of years. She taught a course on the history of photography. And so I was sort of looking around for a project, sort of thinking about what I might do next. And she knew and had taught the work of Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore and said to me, you know, you should look at these photographs. You should look at what they're doing. It's really interesting. And she knew a little bit about the story of the wartime resistance, but she didn't know much. But I started looking at these photos because I always listen to my wife. And so I started looking at these photographs and I thought, yeah, there's really something interesting here. And I want to know more. I want to learn more. And it's kind of similar to the last project, the flood book, because it was just kind of by chance that I came across that story. In that case, we were actually taking a tour of the Paris sewers, as you do. And we came to the end of the tour and there's a little historical display of the history of the sewers. And there was a photograph of the sewers that had flooded in 1910. And I remember thinking, wow, that would make an interesting project one day. And that actually happened to be, we were there in the summer of 2005. And then August of 2005 was Hurricane Katrina. And so in that case, I kind of made the link and I said, yeah, that flood project, that's something I really need to be working on right now. So I've been very fortunate to sort of stumble upon these projects, and people tell me I must have a nose for these things. And, you know, I don't, it's not that I'm looking in the archive for this or, you know, trying to find these stories, but when they've come to me, I've recognized that there's something there. And at least at the very sort of core of it, I think is curiosity, just wanting to know more. And then as I have really tried to investigate, then I found out in both of those cases that really not much had been written about it. So I thought, you know, this is a project to work on.
You're definitely one of those people who, whenever you got something that comes out, I think, oh, like what a great project and what a great thing to work on. And then to read about, you know, I think at first glance, one might say that Paper Bullets, this new book, is, you know, about a completely different set of things, different time, you know, different historical subjects and issues and thematics. But reading it, I definitely felt like I was reading a Jeffrey Jackson book. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
No, you'll have to tell me more. Because of course, when I write a Jeffrey Jackson book, I'm not thinking of it in the same way, I guess.
I just felt like your method, your approach, the way you write, those things. I guess I'm wondering if you see a common ground between the two projects in terms of your way of going about them.
Well, I mean, I guess I do. One thing that I do think has been part of all of my work is that I really try to get down to ground level and I try to think about the lived experience. And that was certainly true in the flood book. And it's definitely true in Paper Bullets as well. I've always defined myself as a cultural historian. And of course, my first book about jazz in Paris was really sort of very much in that mode. But I've also been very influenced, I think, by social history as well. And I think that sense somehow combining cultural and social, really getting down to ground level, thinking about the lived experience, while also trying to get inside the mind of other people and inside the kind of cultural framework. That's what I try to do. And that's when I talk in my classes about, you know, what historians do, you know, trying to understand what it's like to see the world from someone else's point of view. And so I think that's what's partly attracted me to these kinds of stories, is because they do allow me to get into a kind of very specific, you know, almost micro-historical kind of ground level story, but one that then opens up into bigger questions. And I think that's the kind of cultural history influence for me, at least, because when I think about the books that were really influential for me when I was in graduate school and reading, it was always those stories, the little stories that open up into big stories that I found the most fascinating.
Well, and with great success as a reader, I can tell you that.
Well, thank you.
So let's dig in, Jeff, and talk about these two artists who risked their lives to defy the Nazis. Towards the end of the book, you say, and I'm quoting you here, not only have Lucie and Suzanne, Cahun and Moore been written out of the history of World War II resistance, but for decades, scholars ignored them in histories of surrealism, interwar literature and art, gender, sexuality, Jewishness, and the avant-garde. So talk about opening up the story of these two artists, opens up all of these different historical themes and questions. Who were Lucie and Suzanne, who, you know, took on the names Cahun and Moore as artists? What can you tell us about their sort of backstories before you get into their activism in resistance against the Nazis?
It's funny, when I talk about their lives, you know, the bulk of the book is really about what happens during the war. Mm-hmm. But I sometimes say that if you didn't even talk about the war part, just the first part of their lives was an amazing story mm-hmm. as well. So it's almost like, you know, their entire lives had this incredible arc of drama and passion and just all sorts of things going on. So the backstory is that I talk about them as daughters of wealth and privilege. I mean, they grew up in Nantes. They came from money. Lucie's father was a newspaper editor, an owner, and Suzanne's father was a very prominent physician and head of the medical school. So they met when they were very young. Their families were part of society, wealthy society, and so they actually played together as they were small children and got to know each other really from childhood. But at some point along the way, they begin to, especially as they get older, they become teenagers. They fell in love. One of the things that I think is really important about this story, or the way that I tell this story, is to talk about it really as a love story. It's many kinds of stories. It's many things. But at the core of it really is the love story that begins when they are very young. And that love story really carries them through. So, you know, the other important early part of this is, of course, that Lucie is very young when this all happens. But she grows up in the Dreyfus Affair. Mm. And so that also shapes the way that she comes to think about identity. Her father's family was Jewish, although they were assimilated. But in the wake of the Dreyfus Affair, I think, you know, she comes to understand about identity and about politics and the intersection of those things. And she will actually embrace elements of her Jewish background, even though she herself did not practice the faith. She would still embrace elements of her Jewish family identity. And for her, I think it was a way of identifying with the outsider. Mm. Because also from young ages, they were both developing their skills as artists. Lucie really as a writer and Suzanne as an illustrator. And then together they began to collaborate on photography. Neither of them was trained as a photographer. Neither of them knew how to develop film. As best we can tell, they only owned one camera for their entire lives. So The photography in a funny way was really a hobby, I think. But that's what they've now become famous for under their artistic names of Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. But creativity was always a part of their life, and it was always something that they did together. What has often happened is that people have foregrounded the photography and foregrounded the story of Claude Cahun because she's the one in most of the photographs. And that has meant that Marcel Moore has gotten sort of erased from the story. And part of what I'm trying to do in this book, I think, is to really restore this as a story of partnership, both sort of partnership of in their lives and also partnership in their creativity. And that partnership and their relationship then is part of what sustains them through this 4-year campaign of resistance against the Nazis.
In terms of the identity of these two artists, the identities of these two artists, Jeff, and their relationship, what can you tell us, you know, as a researcher and a writer, how you made the choices to refer to their relationship, to refer to them, including, you know, the pronouns that you use throughout the book, and, you know, where that places this book in terms of ongoing debates about how we gender our historical subjects, how we think about their own identities and how they would identify?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And it's something that I've really thought a lot about and throughout the whole process of writing this book, because there are a number of people today who have said, you know, we should be using they, them pronouns to talk about these women. There are a number of people who say, you know, that we should only be using the names Claude Caron and Marcel Moore to talk about them. You know, their whole debates about, you know, not just about them, but obviously larger questions about how we talk about these issues in the past. And the decisions that I made were decisions that were largely based on the sources, first of all, because when I go back and I look at the sources, for example, they never called each other Claude or Marcel. Those were very clearly their artistic names, that they were producing artwork under those names. But when they were writing about each other or writing to one another, they called each other Lucy and Suzanne. Mm. And so in the book, mostly I refer to them as Lucy and Suzanne because I'm mostly writing about their post-Paris years when they leave and they move to Jersey. When I do write about them in their years in Paris, I try to make it clear that they still are seeing each other as Lucy and Suzanne, but sometimes, you know, in the persona of Claude Caron, sometimes in the persona of Marcel Moore. So the sources, I tried to let the sources be my guide, for one thing. So they always refer to themselves as women. They always use she, her pronouns. They always refer to each other as Lucy and Suzanne. I also was very cognizant of the fact of trying not to go back and to place a modern day identity on someone living in the past that they might not themselves have claimed. Now, obviously, I don't know if they were living today in our time, what they might have used different pronouns or they might have, you know, identified in a different way. But thinking about the mental universe that they had access to, you know, in a language like French that's very gendered, at a time when some of these categories were actually in flux, they didn't use the word lesbian to talk about themselves. I never saw in any of the documents that I looked at, I never saw them identify in that way. And of course, the word lesbian didn't mean exactly the same thing, or it was one of several terms that was used at the time to describe the kind of relationship that they had. So I actually did use the word lesbian in the book to talk about them, mostly sort of for convenience sake, because even if they might not have used that word, that is a concept that modern readers would understand. But at the same time, I was also very aware of the complexity around that choice and other choices about pronouns and about gender and naming and so forth. So it's something that I thought a lot about. You know, there may be readers who disagree with my choices, and I respect that. And I certainly, you know, would never want to take away if somebody who, for example, was a trans reader today who looked back at Claude Caron and Marcel Moore and said, I take inspiration from them. They are heroes for me. You know, I would never want to take that away from anybody, or to sort of correct them and say, oh no, we must use historically correct pronouns. You know, people have to sort of think about their own relationship to the past. But as a historian, as a scholar, as a writer, I was trying to be very cognizant of not only my own identity and who I am, and trying not to then impose on others, but also to really kind of be sensitive to the historical moment and to the historical context. So, you know, I hope that I've done a good job, and I've gotten some positive feedback from folks from the LGBTQ community who felt like that it was a sensitive approach. So that was gratifying.
Mm-hmm. I just want to follow up a little bit in terms of accessing their lives, their story, their fascinating story and complicated story. What are you working with in this book? What are the sources and materials that you had access to? You know, the range of those things?
Well, as far as the sources go, there were really sort of three primary bodies of source material that I was drawing from. One was some posthumously published work. In the late 80s, early 90s, they were essentially kind of rediscovered by a French writer and philosopher named François Leperlier, who wrote a biography. And of that biography was of Claude Caron only, not Marcel Moore. And so that thus begins the kind of writing out of Moore from the story. Leperlier compiled a collection of Claude Caron's writings and then published them in the early 90s, I think it was. And so that was one, and it's a very big, fat book. Some people may be familiar with this, and it contains some work that had been previously published and then some work that had never been published before that only existed in manuscript form. So that was one body of source material. But then there were two archival sources or sets of archival sources that I was using. One on the island of Jersey, which is where most of the action of my book takes place. That's where they move. They go after they leave Paris in 1937 and died there and are buried there. And so they had no heirs. And so all of their material was sold basically after Suzanne died in the early 1970s. It was sold at auction. And so some of it ended up in the archive on Jersey through a sort of roundabout way. And then another chunk of it ended up at Yale in the Beinecke Library, their special collections library. And so I spent some time there as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why this story hasn't been told before, is I think the material is kind of scattered. I had to do a lot of legwork to track this down. And I think people who've written about them in the past have focused so much on the photographs, which are amazing and shocking and, you know, beautiful and weird and, you know, all sorts of things. And that's been the, all of that and more. That. And that's been the entree, I think, for many scholars, is to look at the photos. But the archival stuff has been either too difficult to find, or people didn't want to take the time, or maybe they looked at it but just didn't see anything worth using. It's hard to describe how much work went into actually recovering this story. And I really do think that's one of the reasons why people just haven't written about it before, is that it took a lot of work to do it.
Well, I mean, thanks, Jeff, for doing all of that work, because once you read the story, I mean, it's kind of insane to me that this story isn't out there more. Right. Like, it's just, okay, go get a grip and get us back to the place in their story where, you know, you set up the book and really it's that moment in the later 1930s, 1937, when the two of them decide to relocate to Jersey. And that's where they ride out the Second World War and the German occupation. So what sort of is the immediate trigger or reason that they go?
Well, they go in part because Paris has become very difficult, of course, by the mid 1930s, politically very charged environment. There are, you know, fascist and proto-fascist groups in the streets. This is after the Stavisky riots. This is, you know, after so much of, and also during the Depression as well. And so they decide to leave in part because I think they just want to get away from a lot of that. They had been politically engaged for a while. They were friends with communists. They were, you know, they would go to meetings and they would sign petitions. And the surrealists who were their friends, of course, were also very actively involved in left-wing politics, communist politics. But I think they just got tired of it. And I think the other reason, of course, is that Lucy had very serious chronic health issues. And I think there was the sense that Paris was just too exhausting. It was a place that they didn't want to be anymore. You know, they never really say why they leave. But I think, you know, one of the things when you read so much of this material over and over again, and you sort of dig into it, you know, there is a real sense that you kind of feel like you do know them after a while. You read all these their writings, their sources, and even though they don't ever explicitly say, for example, we left Paris for these reasons, I feel like I have gotten to know them so well just through what they have left behind, that what I've just said about, you know, the politics is exhausting and the chronic health issues, that sort of makes sense as the reason for why I think they end up leaving. You know, you develop that sense of kind of, you know, how they thought about the world when you read these kind of sources.
Maybe, Jeff, could you situate us a little bit in terms of Jersey? Like, you know, I know what it is and where it is, but I don't really know a lot about that place. And it is so important to this story and to this period in their lives that the book focuses on. So yeah, could you give us, I mean, the quick kind of rundown of, you don't have to go back centuries and centuries, although you could in the case of Jersey, right? So just situate us in terms of.
Yeah, so Jersey is really just off the French coast. It's just off the coast of Normandy. It's much closer to France than it is to Britain. But it's British territory. It's independent. It's self-governing, but it's loyal to the British crown. All the Channel Islands. So Jersey and Guernsey are the two major islands, and then there's a series of other islands. There's seven inhabited islands in the Channel Islands, and then a few other pieces of territory. So it's much closer to France, and indeed it had been French territory. It had been connected with France in the past, and there's a lot of French influence there. A lot of the old family names are French. or clearly derived from French. A lot of the street names, the place names, the capital of Jersey is Saint-Hélier. You know, there's a lot of Francophone elements to Jersey culture. But politically, as I say, it's connected to Britain and loyal to the British crown. They use British currency. They drive on the left. You know, it feels very British. And yet it also feels very French, too. And I think that was part of perhaps the attraction for them. I mean, they had vacationed on Jersey over the years. So it was a place that they knew. You know, in my sense, I went spent some time there in doing the research. I did kind of feel like I was halfway between London and Paris. You know, it had that kind of, it was familiar. I could see how it would be familiar to people from France and yet also far enough away if you're trying to escape, for example, the crazy politics of Paris in the 30s, that it would be a very, you know, restful place to be. It's an island, there are beaches, there's, you know, it has some of the highest tides in the world. So it's very visually striking. It has these big brown granite cliffs that look out over the ocean. It feels familiar and different at the same time.
And how should we think about the occupation on Jersey differently than as French historians, what are the kinds of things you'd want to draw our attention to in terms of the differences between the occupation in France and what life is like under the German occupation on Jersey?
Well, I think a couple of things stand out. One is that it's cut off. When they do begin to talk about resistance and they begin to think about, you know, how can we resist? It's very clear to them that whatever they do is not going to be connected to anything that's going on in France or in England, for that matter. That these islands are really cut off because there's no way to contact other resistance groups, for example. They're, you know, on the mainland, on the continent, there's no way to be part of the French resistance more generally. They thought at one point about leaving because initially, when the war begins and it's clear that Jersey is in the target, that a lot of people do leave, and they thought about it. But in the end, they decide to stay, in part because they don't think they can do anything anywhere else. But they also recognize that this means that it's going to cut them off. And so I think the fact that this is also a small space, it's highly concentrated, it means that the occupation looks very different in that sense. And also, I think the fact that the islands, the Channel Islands, were strategically very important. They were part of what the Germans called the Atlantic Wall. And the Atlantic Wall was a series of fortifications and defenses that began in Scandinavia and then came through the Channel Islands and then went down the French coast. But the Channel Islands were very important because of their proximity to Britain as well. It was a very intense environment. Not that occupation was not intense in other places, certainly, but because it's such a small space, highly concentrated, and then strategically very important, without the possibility of communicating with any other resistance groups or anyone else for that matter, I think there's real sense. A lot of people on Jersey talked about feeling like they were in a prison the entire time and really sort of just isolated.
Jeff, I feel like I've been holding myself back this entire time to just be like, Paper Bullets, tell us why the book is called Paper Bullets. So tell us why the book is called Paper Bullets.
All right. Well, it is funny. You do have to restrain. I know how it is when you want to get right to the meat of it, but there's this whole backstory. So Paper Bullets refers to what they did. It refers to their technique of resistance. And the way to talk about this is to remember that they were artists and creative people. And so they took those artistic skills. You know, again, Lucy Gluckin is a writer, Suzanne Marcel Moore is an illustrator, and together as working together collaboratively as photographers, they took all of that creative skill and they wrote notes, notes for the Nazis. And that sounds very small and it sounds very insignificant, but the notes that they wrote had a real profound effect on, or profound impact on the German soldiers, because the notes that they were writing were essentially designed to undermine German morale. They were intended to demoralize the troops in the hopes that the troops might desert or mutiny or just leave or go home. The notes took the form sometimes of dialogues, sometimes of poetry, sometimes of song lyrics, sometimes of jokes. Hitler was a frequent butt of the jokes that they would write, and as well as other senior German leaders. And they would leave these notes all around the island. They would put them on a cafe table or slip them into a magazine at the newsstand. Or in some cases, they would actually sidle up alongside of a German soldier and slip it into his coat pocket. Or they would open up the door of a German staff car and slip a note into the car, so that German soldiers would find these notes and begin, hopefully they thought would begin to wonder, you know, first of all, who left this note? All the notes were written in German, I should say, because Suzanne was fluent in German. And so if a German soldier would read the note, he would first of all think, well, okay, was this written by another German soldier? Is there a conspiracy, or are there other, you know, are there other soldiers who have doubts about what we're doing here? But then, of course, the hope was he would read the note and then kind of take the message to heart and maybe think, yeah, why are we here? Why are we on this island? Why are we occupying this territory? And this went on for 4 years in secret. And they sort of escalated as they went along. But that's the core. That's what the paper bullets really refers to, are these notes that they wrote. And we'll never know how many notes that they actually wrote. They were not really keeping count. Eventually, when they were put on trial, there were about 300 notes in the courtroom, but they basically said that was just a fraction of what we really did. So people who are familiar with their photography in the 1920s, you know, there's several dozen photographs that are sort of famous of theirs. But I would say that the creative work that they did on Jersey was far, far more than any of the work that they produced in Paris, because we're talking about, you know, certainly in the hundreds of notes, possibly in the thousands of notes that they were cranking out on a regular basis for 4 years.
It's such a compelling story. I think it's so exciting to read about and to learn about and to, you know, help us to think about the political and other kind of power of art, right? And the kind of intervention it can make. The paper bullets make me think of, you know, the propagandistic leaflets that different sides hurl at front lines and populations during wartime. So it's got that little sort of piece of that there, like it's their version of this, but done so surreptitiously and so on the sly because of the dangers of doing that. You know, there's like a materiality to it that I find completely fascinating. You know, you said, how many did you say?
300 at the trial,
At the trial. And what became of all of those, Jeff?
That's a great question.
I'm sure that Bob, that keeps you up at night, yeah, doesn't it?
Well, it's, you know, the notes that survive are really reproductions. I mean, basically what happened is that after the war, Suzanne went back and recreated many of those notes. And previous scholars really have talked about them and written about them as though they were authentic. But I think it's pretty clear from the archival stuff, if you look at it carefully, that these are actually post-war reconstruction. So it's hard to say, you know, exactly what became of the original notes. They were probably destroyed. At the end of the war, the Germans were burning documents in their headquarters and in the court-martial, probably because they didn't want the Allies to find them. So it's impossible to say what exactly became of those notes. But there, the few that survive that are these kind of reproductions, I would say there's probably about two dozen or so, maybe that we have some kind of access to in that way.
Just to come back to this material question, you know, I also thought, and it comes up in a couple of different ways when you're talking about people's diaries and other types of things, the, you know, shortage of like paper, like that paper was at stake during the war, and that they didn't have Post-its, duh. like they used cigarette paper. And what were the other kinds of things that they used to leave these notes?
They would find, yeah, any paper that they could find, trash. They tore up an old ledger that had belonged to Suzanne's father that they had brought with them to Jersey. Cigarette papers, as you say. They would even paint in nail polish on coins and drop the coins into the donation box at the church. So they would paint "Down with War" in nail polish. So not only on paper, sometimes there was, you're talking about materiality even more, like coins, or they would make these wooden crosses that they would put on that said, "For him, the war is over." And they would put that on the grave of a German soldier who had died either because of illness or some other reason. And that cemetery was just yards from their house. So they were using, you know, paper, but also objects. They would sometimes even use photographs, cut up things that they would find, like take a magazine, cut it up, make a photo montage, just like they had done in Paris with some of their creative work, and rework it, and then put it back in the newsstand for a soldier to find. So they were definitely invested in sort of using as many different kinds of objects and materials that they could to get some kind of message to the Germans. And I think the messages were also, they would vary. Some of them were, you know, designed to look like manifestos. Some of them were designed to be more like, you know, like I said, jokes. Some of them were more kind of more like poetic and sort of lyrical. So there was not even one type of message or one type of object or one type of note. They were really sort of casting a broad net. And I think the idea there was to say, you know, something, if this message doesn't get them, maybe this other message will. You know, if this message isn't connecting with a soldier, then maybe this different type of message will connect with them. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, everyone's different and everyone will respond to a different message. So they were very smart about this. I talk about this very openly in the book as a psyops campaign, psychological operations, because mm-hmm. it's very clear that they, to me at least, it's very clear that they were trying to think about this from a psychological standpoint.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The way that you refer to the campaign is so fascinating to me, especially because of the way their whole story, where they are, who they are, what they engage in terms of these notes and these paper bullets really complicates, you know, something that when I'm teaching this period of history, when I'm thinking about it myself, but especially when I'm teaching it, you know, this question of like, what is resistance? How do we define it? What's the hierarchy of like more important forms of resistance, lesser forms of resistance, all of that. So I guess I wonder, you know, for you, Jeff, how did their story, how did this history, you know, shift your own understanding of how we understand resistance during the period of the Second World War or, you know, ever? And what do you see as the kind of contribution of this history of these two artists to that huge set of debates and, you know, scholarship around the question of resistance?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I can't claim that I have some, you know, big insight into that larger mm-hmm. scholarship, you know, because I think there's been so much great work that's been done to try to sort of conceptualize and theorize resistance and to talk about mm-hmm. it in so many different ways. And I certainly drew on some of that literature. But to me, you know, again, thinking about this kind of at ground level and kind of from the lived experience side of things, it seems to me like this is a story that helps us to really remember that resistance can look different in different times, in different places, in different contexts, that it doesn't always have to be violent. It doesn't always have to be big in scale. It doesn't always, you know, have to be physical. You know, it can be in this kind of small way that is designed to, you know, work in an interior, in the interior life, you know, of the power structure. And one of the questions, this actually kind of reminds me, one of the questions that I've thought a lot about is, you know, whether they really believed that they could actually drive the Germans out of Jersey. Because obviously they didn't do that. And I don't even necessarily think that they believed that they could actually drive the Germans away. I mean, I don't think they were naive in that way at all. But I think that for them, the idea of even just distracting the Germans, in other words, if the Germans are spending their time, because they actually did say this in some of their writing, if the Germans are spending their time searching for us, then they're not doing something else. You know, even just to create a form of resistance that draws attention away from other people is a powerful kind of idea. And when I've talked about this story to various groups, various community groups, and had book club conversations and you know, talked to lots of people, it's been interesting to hear people respond to this issue about resistance and to say things like, you know, I never really thought that resistance could look like this, because I think people start to say to themselves, well, maybe I could do this. This is something I could do. I could be engaged in some form of resistance along these lines. Because I think, you know, again, we often think about resistance has to involve going out in the streets and doing something big and doing something dramatic.
So they do get caught, Jeff, and they're arrested, eventually tried and sentenced to death, even though that sentence is appealed. I almost feel like I wanted us to stay for 4 hours on the story of the notes and all that they accomplish during this period of time. But there are a few different endings to this story and to the history that you've written. But that ending, can you tell us a little bit about how that, after all, because it's amazing that it lasts so long and that they get away with it for so long, and then they are caught and then they are arrested and tried. What are the kind of, without giving away too much, what are the really significant things that readers and potential readers should know about that phase of this history?
So they do get caught and they do get put on trial. And it was great to be able to sort of reconstruct that sort of courtroom drama scene.
Yeah.
It's interesting that in the trial and then in their time in prison, that they continue to resist. I mean, they continue this work of resistance. They continue to pass notes. They meet other prisoners. You know, they help comfort other prisoners, including some of the German soldiers who have been imprisoned for mutiny or for a crime that they've committed. And so there's an interesting sort of way that their time in prison is almost like a continuation of the work that they had been doing before. One of the other powerful things about this story, I think, is that as they approach this note writing, and as they met other prisoners, including German soldiers in prison, it becomes very clear that they see themselves, I think, doing kind of an act of rescue, that this whole project for them has been an attempt to rescue these German soldiers, because they say, well, we know what soldiers were like. Our brothers and cousins served in World War I, and we're not afraid of soldiers. And so there's this real sense of kind of compassion that they have. And you see it in their interactions that they have in the prison, even with the guards, even with the German soldiers who are guarding them. They're never really afraid of these guards. They actually pity them. They feel sorry for them because they say these men have been duped by Hitler. They've been duped by the Nazis. And so there's a real kind of compassion and a real kind of humanity that they bring to this. And it lasts all throughout the last section of the book, I think, that obviously they hate Nazism and they hate what it stands for, but they can separate out the ideology from the men in front of them. And that really sort of, I think, makes a kind of fascinating story that is so unexpected. Because, of course, when you think about prisoners in a Nazi jail, you expect there to be, you know, dramatic scenes of a beating or interrogation and, you know, or something violent. And they didn't experience a physical violence. I think they experienced a kind of psychological violence because they never knew when they might be taken out and shot. I mean, they had a death sentence on their heads after all. But they were still, throughout all of that, they were still able to see these men as human beings and to try to connect with them. And I think that's another, that was a very unexpected part of the story. I'll put it that way, that when I started this, yeah, I didn't expect to find that part. And then to write about it. And that's been another thing I think a lot of audiences have really sort of connected with as I've talked to folks about the book.
I should have asked you this earlier, Jeff, but I'll ask you now. What sense do we have of, like, how aware were people in a more collective sense of what these two were doing? What do we have in terms of a sense of the impact that it had on the soldiers they left notes for? What do we know about the community around them and how they interacted with them and how aware people would have been that this was happening?
I wish I had documents from the soldiers' point of view. That's the one thing that I can't really say exactly what soldiers thought, with a couple of exceptions, because they do actually meet a couple of soldiers in prison who had read their notes and were inspired by them. They were probably soldiers who were already, you know, having their doubts anyway, and the notes probably just sort of confirmed their doubts about the war effort. But nevertheless, they do meet a couple of folks. But more generally, you know, I wish I knew more about what the Germans thought. The one thing I usually say when I think about that, though, is that I don't think that the secret field police would have hunted them for 4 years if it was not a serious thing. So the fact that they were being tracked you know, for that long, and this evidence was collected, speaks to me of the fact that it was having some kind of impact, or at the very least, the police feared that it was going to have an impact on morale in this strategically important place. I forgot the second half of your question.
Oh, how aware other residents on Jersey were of this happening? Like, who knew besides the two of them? You know, what was the... Was there a sense of complicity, awareness, like all of that stuff? The scene that you open the book with has this sort of, like, you get a kind of feeling of like a community vibe, but I don't know if that's just me putting that on there or if it's if it was how people felt about what was happening.
Yeah, they definitely worked alone. They were explicit about saying that they didn't want to bring anybody else into this because they didn't want to risk anyone else's life. Only one other person knew what they were doing, an old friend of theirs that they had met many years ago on Jersey, but she was not involved in the work. She just knew what they were doing. But but they say that nobody else, they say that they intentionally kept this from other people. There were other resistance groups on Jersey. There were other people who were engaged in some kind of resistance, but Lucy and Suzanne never connected with them. You know, partly they say because they were just used to working alone. They were both kind of loners. Lucy especially. Lucy really didn't like other people. she was very antisocial, and so really wanted to kind of just keep to themselves. But I really think it was also the desire not to risk anyone else.
So they are sentenced to death, Jeff, but they aren't executed. Tell us what happens to them after the war.
So when the war is over and the island is liberated, they have to begin to put their lives back together. And their house had been looted by the Germans. All their stuff had been taken. So they really have to go around and hunt for their goods, their books, their furniture, you know, family belongings. They have to go and try to find as much of it as they can. And it was not only the Germans who were taking things, but also other people on Jersey. I mean, this was a, you know, wartime situation. Things were in short supply. And so other people had also, you know, taken things from the house once they were arrested and carried away. So they attempt to rebuild as much as they can. But, you know, Lucy had been, as I said before, had suffered from chronic health conditions for much of her life. And the time in prison certainly had not made that any easier. It had really aggravated some of her lung problems. And so her health really began to decline in the years right after the war. But they were also, those were also the years where they were trying to begin to make sense of things. And so Lucy wrote some lengthy letters to friends. These were some of the documents that were posthumously published, actually, some of these long letters, where she talks about the war experience. She talks about what they were trying to do. She talks about, you know, how they went about the note writing process. And so you get the kind of feeling that, you know, she was trying to get the story out there, at least to some friends and maybe some other notes on paper that she could, you know, maybe one day write something about this. And that there's a sense, I always feel like there's a sense of urgency in those documents that survive, because it was like she had to get the story down before it was all gone, before it was too late. And so that's part of what makes those documents very difficult to work with, because they're very stream of consciousness. They're not in a nice sort of easy logical flow. It's very complicated to read some of those post-war letters and post-war jottings that she does, because it really does feel like she's just got to write this down. It's whether that's her way of dealing with it or whether that's her way of just, you know, getting the story down before it's lost. But it's not long before Lucy's health continues to decline, and eventually she dies in 1954 and is buried on the island. Suzanne buries her, and then Suzanne lives for another 20 years. She continues to do some of their creative work. She continues to take photographs, actually. And then she ends up killing herself in the early 1970s. And it's interesting that she commits suicide, because that was the thing that they were always planning to do if they got caught by the Nazis. They always carried a little bottle in their pocket. And in that bottle was an overdose of a sleeping pill. And they were always ready to commit suicide if they had been caught by the Nazis. And they actually try in prison. They try to commit suicide. more than once, actually. But they're always saved by the Nazis. The Germans take them to the hospital and save them, in part because they want to continue to interrogate them to find out who's been writing these notes. But in the end, Suzanne does kill herself when health issues just become too much for her to bear. Mm. Sorry, I kind of got depressing there by talking about that.
It is a tragic ending, but it's just part of the, like, it's just the last stage of, well, it's not the last stage, but it's just another piece of, you know, what is an incredibly compelling story overall. I want to ask you, Jeff, about writing this book, because, you know, as you said, the archival work and like hunting down all of this material, it comes together as such an intriguing, romantic, exciting, kind of edge of the seat a couple of times sort of story. And I mean, I'm just going to admit to you that I don't remember the Flood book. What was it like to write this book? And I mean, I'm sure it was hard, but what was it like to be able to write a story like that, that has all of those elements? I mean, it almost seems like it's too good to be true in some moments, you know? And I just wonder as a writer what the experience of pulling this book together was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where after it's done, you know, now that it's out and I can see it and go back and look at it, you know, I think to myself, did I do that? Like, was that really me who somehow pulled that off? It almost seems like a miracle in a way, because in the middle of doing it, and this is true with writing in general, you know, in the middle of doing it, it's such a pain, you know, it's so hard because you realize, you know, all of the drama that goes into the act of writing. and then to see it as a finished product and to hear such generous compliments like the one you're paying me, you know, it's sort of like, wow, I almost don't believe it myself. But I think I sometimes say this is actually the hardest book that I think I've ever written, because first of all, I think the French itself was so complicated, I felt like, because it feels very surrealist in a lot of places. and so sorting through something that's kind of stream of consciousness and surrealist and using a lot of references that are clearly very personal references that are not, it's not clear exactly what Lucy, for example, is talking about, you know, it was challenging to kind of just to get inside of her head, first of all. And then, as I kind of alluded to earlier, the state of the sources, that it's not in a very easily accessible it's not easy to follow the logic of the sources. So it really was a lot of, I almost want to say creativity, because even though clearly this is all nonfiction and this is all sourced directly from archival material, it did require a certain amount of creativity on my part to figure out, you know, what order to put things in, right? How to piece the story together. And that's true always, of course, with any work that you write, but it's especially challenging when you are trying to write it in a narrative style. And this book and the Paris Flood book, you know, I wrote them with a broader audience in mind. Of course, I'm always glad that my academic friends, you know, French historians and others, read them and find them valuable and see the academic work that's in there. But I also wanted, you know, to write these stories for people outside of the academic world, because I think they're powerful stories, and I think they speak to the present moment. They speak to our lives. They speak to our sense of humanity and the kinds of issues that we all deal with. And I also feel like as a historian, you know, I feel like we have an obligation as historians to speak to people in a broader way, because, you know, if we don't do that, you know, journalists and other writers will do it, and, you know, call themselves historians, and maybe they are great historians, but I think there's something that we academic historians have to bring to broader conversations that sometimes gets left out, when we don't try to cross over into, you know, writing for bigger audiences. So that adds another level of complexity then to try to tell a story like this, because you have to try to tell it in a way that, I hate to use this phrase, but quote unquote, ordinary people, non-academics, you know, will read it and keep reading it and find it interesting. And that's a real challenge to do. And I was very lucky to have a great editor to work with on this book, you know, and also friends to read it and to give feedback and, you know, just like you would with an academic book, but also to have people who are also trying to do this work of, you know, crossing over into writing for broader audiences. So I was lucky to have some folks within the academic world who are doing that work too, and to get their feedback on things as well. So it's challenging in, you know, in lots of ways that sometimes I think that I didn't even expect.
Well, you know, given the book that you've written and given how long it's taken me to actually get through my stack of books so that I could speak to you about this book, I know that you have had just a tremendous response to the book from all sorts of corners. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you've gotten to speak with and, you know, what that experience has been like, having a book that you're able to share with so many different types of readers?
Yeah, I can't even keep track at this point, but I've spoken to, I've done sort of most of this, I should say, has been has been virtual because of the pandemic.
Sure.
So I really haven't done any live events, I don't think. It's all been over Zoom or some other platform. But, I've spoken to large audiences. I've done things through organizations like the International Spy Museum in Washington hosted me. The National World War II Museum in New Orleans hosted me. I've been hosted by LGBTQ groups who are interested in this because it is a story of, it's a lesbian love story, basically, right? And so they've hosted me. I did actually just the other night, I did a book discussion group with our local LGBTQ community center here in Memphis and had a wonderful conversation, just a really rich conversation because people were, you know, were really interested in the book and they were engaging with it both on an intellectual level, but also on a personal level. Almost in a personal level that I wasn't even expecting how personal that they were going to get. But I've seen that in a number of cases where people have really sort of, this story has resonated with them in their own lives. And that's been such an amazing thing to have happen. I've spoken, you know, through various public libraries and, you know, all sorts of different types of organizations. So that's very gratifying to have a kind of wide reach, you know, because that's, of course, that's what any author hopes for, to be able to speak to people and to have them read your work and to get inspired by it. So I just feel very lucky to do that. And also, you know, honored to be on your podcast because, you know, that it suggests that, you know, academic readers can also get something from this. It's something that hopefully can continue to speak to the academic world, even as I'm also speaking to folks more broadly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I found this book so fascinating as someone who works on the 20th and 21st centuries, as someone who teaches France in the 20th century, but also a specific class on a course on France during the Second World War. The book came out, you know, after I had to put in my order for the course that I taught in 2020. So I didn't get to use it. And I found myself as I was reading it thinking, oh, I wish this book had been out when I taught that course, because I know that it would have been a way into so many important questions about the Second World War, about the occupation, about resistance, about gender and sexuality during this period, about art and politics, like all of these things that I'm also just interested in. And so, yeah, I really, I don't know when I'm going to teach that course again, but I think it would be an amazing book to teach with as well. I can't imagine what could possibly follow this act, Jeff, but what do you have planned? I mean, you've had a busy year, and I know I kind of hesitate to ask people what's next for them during this period of time, because I feel for a lot of people, you know, just surviving is next for them.
Right.
But do you have ideas about a next project, and what's that going to be?
I do have ideas about a next project, and I don't want to say too much just because it's so early in the process. And also because, and I don't even know if I should say this on the New Books in French Studies podcast, but it's actually not about France.
That's okay. That's okay. We welcome all spaces.
No, there's a fascinating story from the Cold War period that I've long been drawn to, and I really want to try to explore that. So I've actually been teaching this semester. I've been teaching a course on Europe and the Cold War, kind of as a way to help me to kind of do some background reading and things. So I've maybe I shouldn't say much more. Well, I'd say this is actually a German story. So, okay. You know, it's a Berlin story. So we'll see where this goes and if it goes anywhere, and maybe not, but it's something that it's one of those things that, again, like with Paper Bullets and like with Paris Underwater, the small story that opens up into something big. I mean, I think that seems to be the theme of my writing life. And those are the kinds of stories that I'm drawn to as a reader too, I think. So it kind of falls in that same vein. So there's continuity there, even though it's maybe about a different country or different context. It's still methodologically kind of in that same vein of small stories that when you zoom out, you see a much bigger picture.
Well, Jeff, whatever it's about, I hope I get to speak with you about it somehow, someday.
I would love that.
And I'm intrigued, you know, because having read this book, I just feel like intrigue is such a big part of of my mood right now.
Right.
So, Jeff, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for writing this wonderful book.
Well, thank you so much for all of your kind words and for the opportunity to speak to you. I love this podcast. You're so great at hosting it. Yeah. And it's such an honor to be here talking to you.